From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Dr. Jeff Sharman is Director of Research at the Willamette Valley Cancer Center Institute located in Eugene. Thank you so much for coming on the Oregon Grapevine.
Barbara, thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with the very kind of beginning with the fact that besides being a scary word, cancer has a definition. So what actually is cancer?
Yeah, so, you know, cancer is a disease that arises from virtually any tissue in the body, and it becomes an unregulated growth of that tissue, growth and potentially spread where it doesn't belong. And so breast cancer is a cancer of breast tissue that sort of fails to respond to the normal on-off circuitry of cellular being and forms a cluster of cells. That cluster of cells then goes on, becomes a nodule. It can spread to lymph nodes, spread other parts of the body, and in doing so causes disruption in those locations. And so that can occur really in any tissue from breast to lung, colon, prostate, and so forth, all the cancers that you're familiar with.
And you have a specific area within the broader world of cancer, which has to do kind of with blood cancers. Talk a little about that and how you found that piece to be the part that is where you want to go with your professional life.
I've been in practice now 18 years, which means medical school was longer ago than that. I sort of lose track. But even as an undergraduate and early medical student, the immune system to me was this just sort of beautifully elegant. I mean, it's truly amazing. Like if you dive deep on how the immune system works, it's breathtaking. And so I became interested in cancers of the immune system, most notably lymphomas and some leukemias, and the treatments that were applied to them and so forth. And that really is true today. I'm as much captivated by the immune system now as I was 25 years ago.
And when we talk about research to someone, and I'll use myself as the example, the picture in my head is, you know, hanging around a lab and doing kind of little test tubes and liquids and Bunsen burners and that kind of stuff. So tell me really, as a researcher, what do you do?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So research is this gargantuan enterprise that has at one end what you describe, laboratory. And during my fellowship training at Stanford, I did work in a laboratory and quickly found that I had no place in a laboratory. I wasn't very good at it. Where my particular research has focused is on the clinical development of drugs. So, you know, I think what you're describing is a lot of the work oftentimes that goes into the creation of a drug, even before it goes into patients, you know, understanding the fundamental biology and what makes cells tick, what turns them on and turns them off. But you can only go so far with those laboratory experiments, and then you have to begin testing them in humans. And you can imagine testing drugs in cancer patients has all sorts of, you know, both good and bad and so forth. And where I've been incredibly fortunate is, you know, in the last decade, we've seen such breathtaking progress in how cancer is treated. And all that's played out in the clinic. You know, for many patients, the best drugs have been available only in the context of research studies or only been made available because of research studies. So I see a patient with leukemia, and they're coming up upon a treatment choice. And we then have to make a decision as to, do we give them the standard, the tried and true, or do we try something that may hold promise for something better? And there's lots of different stages of clinical development. There's early drug studies where we're trying to figure out what dose to use and what's safe. There's mid-range studies where we're trying to get an estimate of how well something works. There's later stage research, phase 3 studies that say, hey, we think we've got something new. We're going to compare it to the standard. And, you know, different studies for different patients, different contexts.
I know that there are people in your field of expertise and research here, there, and no doubt in many other places in the country and in the world, doing perhaps similar work. How does it work for you all communicating in terms, is it just kind of strictly reading kind of really esoteric things, or do you have gatherings or conversations where you say, I had this patient who tried this, etc.? How does it work in terms of communicating around that?
You know, this is something that's evolved over decades. And nowadays, when we are performing a late stage study, these are huge efforts, oftentimes multinational efforts, and centrally coordinated, such that we might have a, I mean, I we just designed a study not too long ago, or finished up a study, you know, 900 patients enrolled across, you know, several hundred centers in 23 countries. So these are large enterprises for late stage studies. And part of the, being a clinical researcher is integrating into that process, helping ensure that the clinical trials are done in a way that, you know, focuses on patient safety, but also the objectives of learning something that can move the field forward to maybe get a new drug approved. Of course, those are late stage studies. Earlier stage studies oftentimes might be a small group of three or four centers across the country working to figure out a dose for a new experimental therapeutic. And those might involve, you know, weekly phone calls addressing safety issues and so forth. So there's a huge range in clinical research in terms of how we develop drugs.
And without getting into the weeds of politics particularly, I'm imagining that we hear certainly that some drugs are available in one country and they may not be available in another country. And so I'm going to go to Mexico, or I'm going to go to Thailand, or I'm going to go somewhere to get this thing that I can't get. How does that kind of work when maybe you know that something is a drug that's going to work, but you can't get it here, etc.? What do you do?
Yeah, it's a phenomenal question. I'm actually really glad you asked that one. Let me kind of take a step back and come at this a little bit tangentially, which is that there are different regulatory environments in each of those jurisdictions, right? So Europe has the EMA, the United States has the FDA. In some countries, things might be approved but aren't reimbursed by insurance. Sometimes, you know, it used to be that things always got approved first in the United States, then spread to the rest of the world. That's not always true anymore. Sometimes things do get approved in Europe before the US. But those are what I would refer to as scientifically validated, regulated type therapeutics. In part, in the question you asked is about, you know, alternative therapeutics and things that may not cross that regulatory threshold. And I guess where I would say there is, wow, buyer beware. I have seen what I consider just complete malpractice at times of people going to pursue therapeutics outside of our country, sometimes with maybe getting an evaluation in Arizona and then crossing the border to get the therapy. And I've seen fraud in that regard, which is really frightening to me, because I think, look, patients with cancer are, in many cases, you know, look, there's reasonable skepticism of the medical establishment. They want to choose their own path through these things. You know, I guess what I would say in those environments is to have an honest discussion, open discussion with one or two opinions here before traveling internationally to get something more interesting. But circling back to your original question, you know, how quickly are therapeutics available and so forth? I think that there are times where it makes sense to travel for research studies. And as a doc, if I know something's out there that's really impressive, I've got no issue sending somebody somewhere to get it if I don't have it. You know, that's part of being a doc for a patient, is always kind of trying to look out for what's gonna give this patient what they're looking for.
You touched on, and of course, we know this is the case, that especially cancer can be pretty scary. Perhaps a patient can be somewhat fragile in a different way than if you come in with a broken femur, let's say. So you love the immune system and you are attracted to that piece. But there, I would imagine, this other piece of having to deal with people who are in very emotionally perhaps difficult places in their lives when they've gotten this diagnosis. Why are you attracted to that, and what do you do?
Yeah. Oh, boy, you got good questions. So Barbara, you know, I think that you only get to pursue so many things in life, right? And how you spend your time is something that's really sacred to everybody, right? And to me, the existential value I get in helping patients, I don't think I could find anything comparable in all of anywhere. And maybe it's how I'm wired. I get it. But I know this is true of a lot of my colleagues. Meeting somebody who is scared, frightened, terrified, whatever the word is, and you are almost automatically entrusted with helping that patient. I mean, it is the greatest privilege you could imagine. And it's a responsibility that's sacred in so many ways. You know, if you take advantage of that, karma will catch up with you quickly, right? So I'm sitting at my desk at work right now, and I have a bottom drawer that is filled with 20 years of thank you letters. And to me, that's something that you can't get in any other job. You know, I mean, it's really, so I love that process. You know, one of the cancers I take care of more than any other is called chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And for many patients, in fact, I would say the majority of patients, we don't even necessarily have to treat it just when it's diagnosed. We can watch and wait and treat when we need to treat. And, you know, I have patients who walk into my clinic knowing they've got leukemia, and, you know, so often I get to hear people walk out, go, "Oh, that wasn't so bad," you know, or "That's not as bad as I thought." And to me, it's incredibly satisfying.
How did you find being a doctor? Was it something you knew you wanted to be when you were a kid, or what was your kind of path to get here?
Yeah. No, I didn't. In fact, I sort of thought pre-meds were a pretty miserable group of humans. I was not even pre-med in college, but I was oriented, you know, my major was actually cellular biology. So it was the understanding of what makes cells work and their on and off switches. And I had some exposures in my, you know, high school that led me to that. And then in college, interestingly, that there was some coursework I took on viruses and immunology, actually. So it was my immunology class in college that really sparked an interest. Interestingly, I took my final exam with the flu and I had a temperature of 104 while I was taking the final exam. So I was sort of a living, but that interest has been sustained, and you know, you just kind of find things along the way that you like. So I got a solicitation letter during my final year of college for Doctors Without Borders. And I thought to myself, that's what I want to do with my life. And now that's not what I've done, but it was a turning point for me to pursue that path.
And besides being a patient care doc and being here and doing research, I know you give presentations in other places. So you have connections to other people and other professionals in your field that is unusual in the way that not necessarily I don't want to say normal doc, but a regular practicing physician might have. So how does that work for you in terms of sharing that information, maybe with colleagues and just personally with you in terms of what you learn?
Right. So our group in Eugene is actually situated. We have a management organization with one entity called US Oncology, and then our research platform has another brand. It's called Sarah Cannon Research. We actually take care of 1 in 5 cancer patients in the United States. And my job, well, one job in addition to seeing patients is I'm in charge of the blood cancer research program for this larger entity. And, you know, you made mention of politics and so forth earlier, you know, and avoiding the hot button issues, but clinical research in the United States is a very dynamic space. And to be responsible for 1 in 5 cancer patients in the United States, we really are in the driver's seat for clinical research. And I will say that we punch well above our weight class, if you will, in Eugene, that we've been able to bring not only groundbreaking research, but like some of the most amazing dynamic changes in the field. There's a drug called ibrutinib that was just this paradigm-changing drug that actually sold from one company to another for $21 billion. That should tell you how valuable it is. It completely displaced chemotherapy in the disease. And the very first patient with CLL in the entire world treated with it was here in Eugene. And that was a research project we brought here because we really believed in the target and so forth. So through the years, we've created a culture here in Eugene where we only hire docs that are research oriented. And so we've really been able to develop a portfolio of physicians across a variety of disease states that now provide leadership within this larger organization of Sarah Cannon and US Oncology. So we have a trial portfolio here that I think would rival most any university, probably better than most universities, maybe equivalent to some of the really good ones. And that spares patients here from having to fly down to Houston or to drive up to Seattle or so forth. We can do it here in Eugene, and like really authentically do it here. I mean, it's not window dressing. We have an incredible team of docs here.
On kind of a personal note, I would think, I know for all doctors, there needs to be time for them to stay healthy, whether they decide to run marathons or whether they decide to play music or whatever it happens to be. And I would think, especially with doctors who are oncologists, from my perspective, it would be very easy to get lost in sadness or whatever. How do you stay where you are in terms of centering? What do you do?
Well, I thought I was doing it well until I realized I wasn't. Just vulnerably, I lost a friend to cancer, and it really triggered a lot. It made me realize I wasn't maybe as healthy as I thought I was. Research for me has always been about hope. Hope that the progress we're making can impact the patients we have here in front of us. I like to run. My poor Peloton bike has over 10,000 miles. My dog goes on lots of walks. I have a wonderful family with just great kids, and I feel very blessed to have them. But I guess I would say I would come back to where we started or where we went earlier on in this conversation is going back to the idea of doing something meaningful. Meaningful doesn't mean pain-free. In fact, I think meaningful sometimes does involve pain in ways that are unique. I still feel after 20 years of this that I get more meaning than I get pain. It's a special job.
On that note, I want to thank you so much for the work you do, unless you want to add something that we have skipped over here. I really appreciate your time today, Dr. Jeff Sharman, and just what you're doing for people, and good job walking your dog.
Thank you. He's a little fat, but maybe I'll get him out for more walks.
thank
Thank
you.
you,
Thank
Barbara.
you for your time. You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.